It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Some of Alaska's toughest outdoor people are scientists. They don't go out for fun, although some do enjoy their expeditions, and they often go places that no one else is interested in visiting, looking for data rather than fish, game, or scenery. When I asked one Arctic scientist about his adventures, he said he preferred not to talk about them because adventures were mistakes, risks, and maybe lost data. Field scientists are at work, and they avoid surprises. So for our topic today, adventures in field science, we'll look at how to avoid adventures with some field scientists who have been to some very remote places in Alaska. And I'm also hoping to learn a bunch about what they're studying and how they go about that. And my first guest of several we're going to have today is Morgan Blanchard, who is a PhD senior project archaeologist with Northern Land Research Alaska. And you go out to study cultural resources, essentially when projects demand or when there's some need for somebody to know about what the cultural resources are there to comply with, you know, federal law and regulations and so forth, right? Tell us sort of about a thumbnail of what a cultural resource archaeologist does, because I think it's something that many people probably never even heard of.
Sure. There's a public image of archaeology. There's actually two. One is Indiana Jones and the other, right. The other is the Smithsonian or somebody.
Who would probably be the worst archaeologist ever.
Yeah, right? Yeah, absolutely. We don't
call
do that.
Call him a grave robber. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's some elements of that actually, not the grave robbing part, but in Alaska, there's certainly some of that adventure. But a cultural resources archaeologist is somebody who's brought in to do studies to understand cultural resources. Usually when there's a project being undertaken, there's some federal laws. The National Historic Preservation Act has some sections, specifically one called Section 106, which says if there's a federal undertaking, which is a dollar or land or permit that's required for a project, that you have to take into account what the effect of the project is on cultural resources. And a big part of that is determining what there's out there, what the cultural resources could be. And so there's some good information about previous research and what things are in the area. But often, as you point out, we can be headed to places where nobody's been or nobody's really looked at that. And so that often involves fieldwork, going out and looking around to see what we can see.
Right. So you were mentioning going to Woodtichick State Park, and that sounds like a pretty nice assignment.
Oh, yeah. I think that ruined me for everything else. some of these projects were out in places where we're sleeping in a tent or on the floor of the school in some community because it's the only place that can house you. But that one was great because we were the cost of getting in and out of Woodtichick State Park is so expensive that it was actually cheaper to pay to house us all at one of the best fishing lodges in the area. So we were there with
Sweet.
People. Yeah, it was great. We were there with people who were paying $7,000 a week to go fishing, and these, you know, dirty archaeologists are getting up every morning and getting on a beaver and flying out and doing our work for the day and coming back to fantastic food and a nice clean bed, and it was great.
That must be an exceptional situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think I've ever had one quite like that. The only one that came even close to that was a job that I was doing with some drillers, actually, and we always travel pretty light because we were trying to go in and out in helicopters and things, but drillers don't travel light, so they brought a barbecue and steaks and everything else. It was the best way to do field work, but we don't get to do that often.
So let's just take this example you were mentioning at Woodtichick. So you're flying out in the beaver and you're being dropped off somewhere. And then what do you do?
Well, in that particular case, we were looking to see if there were any cultural resources around a lake that had not really been surveyed before. And so we had an inflatable boat, and so they would drop us off at the beaver. We'd climb into the boat and then go around and conduct pedestrian surveys and subsurface testing on what we thought were high probability areas to contain.
So you're essentially bushwhacking and just walking around and just looking for something that might or might not be there?
Well, yeah, but it's more scientific than that. There are models for areas where human behavior, or protohistoric or prehistoric humans, would likely be.
Right. So they'd be just like us. They choose the best spot to catch some fish.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There's a saying, you know, archaeologists will say a good place to live is a good place to live, you know. And so in many cases, if you looked at the landscape and were looking to catch fish or go hunting or things like that, it was assuming that things were pretty similar in previous times, as long as it wasn't under ice or something. That might be a good place to go and look for prehistoric or protohistoric activity.
Huh. And I would think that you could do that for quite a while without finding anything.
You can. Yeah, we've had surveys where people looked for, you know, 4 months at a time and came back with two rocks in a can, but...
Oh, that would be frustrating.
It can be, but at the same time, you know, we've also had projects where I was on a project this summer where we were there for 3 days and came up with 1,400 artifacts, so...
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so...
Where was that?
That was Kotzebue. So that, you know, we know Kotzebue is a pretty dense archaeological district. It's well known, and so we were taking special care about that, but... it just depends on where the project is. And frankly, for some of the projects, or most of the projects we're working on, nothing is a good idea. That means that They've picked a good place that's not going to necessarily have a big impact on cultural resources, which would cause them problems.
In a way, you don't want to find it.
In a way, we don't want to. And that's very that's actually probably the biggest distinction between us and like an academic archaeologist would be. I remember we were working on a project with some national parks people, and we were flying along looking at our survey area, and the Park Service guy's like, oh, we should go up there. That's the place. That's the place. And we're like, yeah, it's exactly the place, but we're not going there because the road doesn't go there and they don't want to go there.
Right.
So, you know, we were actually trying to guide our proponent through an area and give them a route that's going to avoid having an effect on these very significant places that are very important to the history of Alaska and understanding, you know, the history of the occupation of America and, you know, just global history, essentially.
Right, right. So if you find something, then they need to reroute the road or you need to do a big dig or something.
Yeah, it's what we need to do is determine, one, is there anything there? That's what they call a level one survey. Two is... is whatever is there, is that eligible for listing on the National Register, which would make it a historic property, which kicks in a lot of those legal effects that we're talking about. And if, in fact, we do find something like that, then we would recommend sometimes to the client, hey, maybe if you changed this a little bit or rerouted, you could avoid, you could mitigate this. And then you get into something called mitigation, and mitigation is... might be something like, let's dig it all up. Let's do a scientific dig and record all the information, remove that data, so that then you could build your road over this or your tower on this or whatever it is, not have an effect. But it could also be something like, hey, we could talk to the village, and the village might want to have something else done. They would like to have some sort of interpretive thing done or a museum exhibit, or they might feel that there's a more important, better way to mitigate something than just digging it up. So creative mitigation, what that's called, and that's an important thing.
Yeah. So tell me about some of the more difficult field situations you've been in. I mean, I imagine there must be some very cold, wet, tough spots where you have to work.
Yeah, it can be fun. One thing is for us, we pretty much only work in the summertime because if we need to do subsurface testing,
the ground's frozen, you can't.
We can't
it
do
out.
That, yeah. And if it's covered in snow, you can't see anything on it. So yeah, it has to be pretty much in the summer. But that doesn't mean it's always nice. You know, I've been out on really wonderful days flying around in a helicopter, and you're great, but then you go up to the top of a mountain someplace, and it's howling wind and freezing, and your camera instantly ices over, and, it, you know, you're up there in these buffeting winds freezing your tuchus off.
Yeah.
And yeah, it makes work a little tough, and that can be an adventure. Wildlife is always an adventure. You run into some interesting things out there, muskox, bear, caribou, different things. And
it sounds like you've seen an amazing amount of Alaska.
Yeah, and as you point out, it's fun to do this job because when you go to villages, people think it's a neat job, and they kind of incorporate you. They'll come and go, oh, what are you doing? And the little kids follow you around, and that's great. And you can really get information, talk to people on a basis. You're not a stranger. You're somebody there doing a job and having a role in the community, and they find that fascinating. But at the same time, as you point out, sometimes we get to places where there's just not a whole lot of evidence that anybody's ever really been there before, not related to the project. And, you know, Alaska's a funny place because I've heard it said that, you know, parts of Mars are better mapped than parts of Alaska as far as being accurate.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you get to places where you'll do a survey and then it's supposedly in one land jurisdiction, but in fact, I got to get the cadastral survey people out there to actually figure it out whether you really are.
Figure out where you are.
Yeah, exactly, or where the distinction is. And land status is a huge issue for us in Alaska because there are so many different land status, and the legal frameworks for each of these land ownerships are different. We need to be very careful about that.
Yeah, I've talked to Arctic field scientists who talk about like the village people don't go here. It's really pretty far out. There's no reason for them to go here. We're just somewhere where maybe nobody has ever really gone very much.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a popular perception that people say this. They say, oh, you know, nobody's ever been here. People have been there. Somebody went there and figured out not to go again, maybe.
Right,
might be a thing where they go, oh, don't go out there. There's no food. There's no game. Don't go there. But there are definitely places where there is a higher probability that people had a significant occupation.
From your point of view, you're not interested in places that nobody's ever been because you're looking for cultural resources.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, you know, you want to test the negative too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we make assumptions in our models about where people would likely be, but you can't just do that. You have to go out sometimes and test those areas where you look at it and go, there's nobody going to be out there, but you have to go look to get that data to make sure that your model is correct.
Yeah, yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is adventures in field science. We're talking about scientists who do pretty amazing outdoor stuff, not for fun, but because they're looking for scientific data. And my first guest today, who's with me right now, is Morgan Blanchard. Morgan is a senior project archaeologist with Northern Land Use Research, which is a company that does cultural archaeology for a purpose. In other words, to build a road or for some other reason where there's some money out there that has to comply and make sure that, you know, they don't destroy cultural resources, and they bring in Morgan and his colleagues to do that. You mentioned a working with sort of construction crew type field crews, and I've there are these different sort of cultures and field camps out there, right? I mean, I've been to scientific field camps but then sort of the construction mining field camp is a whole different thing, where it'll be pretty muscular, it'll be pretty they'll have lots of good food, they'll have, you know, comfy beds, and then they work in equipment most of the day. Whereas in a scientific field camp, might be a little looser. And when people go out to work, a lot of times they're just exposed to the elements and they're doing some pretty tough stuff. Do you see sort of a culture, sort of different cultures when you're working in one of those big construction camp type settings?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. We, you know, the thing is that it's actually kind of rare that we're there when the construction guys are there.
Because you're right. Unless something's gone wrong,
right,
I guess.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And one of the times when that happens is when, say, for example, I worked on projects where we identified something that was significant where they're going to be constructing. And we said, hey, you need to have somebody monitor it and make sure that they don't knock over that cairn or dig up that thing. And so then we'll go back out and monitor those events. And so, yeah, there I think there definitely is. Those guys, I would never criticize them at all, but they have a very different kind of work than we do. We end up, frequently we'll go out just because of the travel costs of getting out to some of these places are just astronomical. So we'll go out and work 12-hour days, you know, walking pedestrian survey tracks or digging test units or flying from site to site. We'll try to get as much work as we can in for the day. And essentially, sometimes our limiting factor is what the pilot can fly in a day legally. And so he can only be on so much time.
So you've got a helicopter that's dropping you down at different spots and you're exploring,
yeah.
And jump back on the helicopter.
Yeah,
and go.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And so we work a lot at helicopters. And I think that's one of the unique things about Alaska is I worked in other places, California, Nevada, Wyoming, I mean, different places, Colorado, and almost every place you can get to by road one way or another or by a reasonable amount of walking. That's not true in Alaska. And so we spend a lot of time in a helicopter or a float plane or sometimes by boat in order to get to places. So, so we really try to stretch out that day and make sure that we're getting the best bang for the buck for our clients to get that work done.
I spent some time at the Tulik Field Camp, which is near Galbraith Lake on the Dalton Highway north of the Brooks Range. It's sort of in the northern foothills of the Brooks Range. Super beautiful place. Really great walking because it's nice dry tundra and you can go forever. But I was so impressed with the scientists that were working there because they were going out into the field to do mostly ecological work and also some lake studies, and just being eaten alive by mosquitoes, being rained on. It was cold. They would, you know, go out in the field in tents, and then they'd be snowed on. Their tents would be crushed. And there was this spirit that they had. I remember there were these guys who were studying these little tundra plants that you couldn't only tell apart with like a microscope, you know. And they're sitting there counting them, just being eaten alive. And I could 5 minutes, and they couldn't wear a head net because they had to look at these things, you know. Oh my gosh, these guys are saints. I mean, sometimes it seems like you must just think, what the heck am I doing out here?
Well, there are some times where you have that. But the truth of the matter is, you know, that you get to you don't get to this point getting through all the education and the dedication to the field and to your topic. You don't get to this point because you didn't like it. Mm-hmm. Nobody trips into this job. You got to work pretty hard in order to get here. And so
there's a level of fascination there.
Yeah, and commitment too, you know. And so, there have been days when you're covered in hundreds of mosquitoes and you're soaking wet or freezing or whatever that you go, I can't wait to get back.
You're not finding anything.
You're not finding anything. And you can't wait to get back. But you still want to go again. I mean, this is what you want to do. The search for the wonderful, interesting stuff is what it's all about. And you know, the field work in itself is its own reward to a certain extent. Although, you know, by the end of the field season, it's pretty nice to get back into the office and write reports. But by the springtime, you're looking forward to getting out there and doing that research.
Yeah, so. Just like all the hundreds of fishermen and hikers.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me about like maybe some of the coolest stuff you found that was, you know, that was unexpected. Because your work sounds a little bit like a treasure hunt.
Well, it kind of is. Although we want to make sure that people understand that, you know, they shouldn't go looking for this stuff, but there's some.
But I mean, from an intellectual point of view, it must be really cool when you find something that nobody knew was going to be there.
Exactly. Well, I can stretch back a little bit. I think one of the things I'm best known for, I found most fascinating was when I was doing my doctoral research, I was digging up telegraph stations, and I found a privy. And historical archaeologists love privies because people drop things into them and they don't go get them.
Of course, so yeah.
I've dug privies all over the place. But the
thing that sounds, of course, hopefully biodegradation has taken place, right?
Yeah,
You're not dealing with fresh whatever.
That's right. But the interesting thing about Alaska, of course, is that it's frozen.
Oh.
And so I was digging this privy and I came back with bags and bags and bags of newspapers. And
oh, wow.
So it was...
Which people had been using for...
Toilet paper, yes.
Okay.
There was some creative description in the write-up of that one. But we ended up finding, I think it was 68 different publications from all over, from 1900 to 1909. We found notes written on them. We found a letter that was to a guy that we knew because of the history. We knew him and where he was. And so it was great because we could begin to look, for example, at what people were reading, and that told us things about what their interests were and possibly what their political affiliations were, some of their hometowns. There are multiple papers from Zanesville, Ohio, and as far as I know, nobody gets the Zanesville papers if they didn't come from there. And one of my favorite was Muncie's Magazine, which was kind of a true crime magazine of the early 1900s. It was criticized for its depiction of scantily clad women and nude statuary, which I always thought was fun. But
that's amazing. And it's so like the things that we're leaving behind that we have least expectation anybody's going to be interested in.
Yeah.
Like the toilet paper.
Right.
Ends up being what's fascinating for another generation.
And it could really tell us a lot about it. But the thing that was funny was that you were talking about biodegradation. And yeah, it was pretty clean relatively, but it smelled pretty interesting. So I got kicked out of a number of labs for that one.
Sure.
But, you know, that took us a year to process.
Uh-huh.
And but it's that kind of thing where we didn't know what it was when we found it. We thought it was really interesting. Nobody had ever really looked at it that way. And so we dedicated ourselves to doing that, brought it all back, studied it, and learned something fascinating.
Cool.
Yeah. And so
all you kids out there thinking about archaeologists.
Yeah.
there you go. You can find yourself studying toilet paper.
Sure. Sure.
Right. Well, I'm just teasing, Morgan. It does sound fascinating. Thanks so much for being with us, Morgan Blanchard. He's a senior project archaeologist with Northern Land Use Research. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So we're going to be talking to some more scientists later in the show, but right now, imagine spending 3 months on a windy island at the tip of the Aleutian Chain. There's no internet, no cell phones, and not much company, besides millions of seabirds who flock to Baldir Island to build their nests. For some wildlife biologists, that setup is paradise, and they'll do just about anything for the chance to find out what life looks like from Baldir. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal traveled to the island to bring back this story.
It's the night before Ryan Mong is scheduled to start work. He crawls into the cargo hold of the research vessel Tekla and runs down his list of supplies.
All these white boxes are the food that we've ordered from a distributor, packed up things we really like. The srirachas, like the stuff that you just always have a lot of back home.
And can't get on Baldir Island. It's more than 300 miles west of Adak. Unlike other parts of the Aleutians, Baldir was too isolated to be used as a breeding ground for foxes. Without those predators, the seabird colony took off. Baldir is now the most diverse nesting spot in the entire Northern Hemisphere and a research station for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. It's also a legend among field biologists like Ryan Mong.
You know, it's like, oh, you get to ride a boat for 2 weeks out to the end of the Aleutian Chain, and there's so many seabirds that they're going to hypnotize you. So I immediately got on the email, sent the resume off.
It took 3 years, but Mong finally won a job studying bird nests on Baldir with two other scientists. He knows it's not for everyone.
To describe it to my family, I just call it, you know, National Geographic syndrome. You want to go to the wildest places, the places with the most species, enjoy the show, and it's quite a show.
Once the ship pulls up to Baldir, Mong and his colleagues start moving hundreds of pounds of food and tools into an inflatable skiff. From there, they ferry each load onto the beach. The crew of the research vessel lends a hand, along with Jeff Williams, assistant manager of the Alaska Maritime Refuge. As he waits for more cargo, Williams points to a boulder resting on the shore.
Where that puffin just landed right there, you might find like 4 or 5 burrows around this rock, and storm petrel is nesting in that grass tussock on top and puffins underneath, and from the different angles, and it's just Swiss cheese just really describes it.
Finding the holes is the first step to doing research on bull deer. Every time Williams hires a new crew, he has them chart out a handful of nests from each species. Then the team hikes back over the course of the summer to see how many eggs hatch and what happens to the chicks. It's all part of a long-term project to pick out trends in bird populations. It also provides clues about possible changes in the oceans around bull deer. And it all starts here.
If you think about it, every one of these bird poops, there's millions of them. So it's like millions and millions of pounds of fertilizer coming onto this. So it creates this vegetation that's super dense and rank. I bring machetes and stuff for people to cut their way through the pass.
Williams has run research stations all across the refuge. Bull deer is the biggest, with a wooden cabin and weatherport tents. Still, Williams says,
if you can be a camp leader or a worker at bull deer, you really earned your stripes.
The weather is bad, the days are long, and the pay is about $15 an hour. Williams says it takes a special kind of person to sign up, or a special kind of couple. Before Bull Deer Island, Mackenzie Mudge and Kevin Pietschuk met at a research site in Antarctica.
And so they hired me on, and I trained Mackenzie. And after that, we traveled together and had a good time.
When was that?
2008, 9?
9-10.
9-10?
Yeah, 9-10. How do you keep all of it straight?
I don't.
It's not uncommon for scientists to fall in love out in the field. But for the most part, Mudge and Pietschuk have stayed there, studying birds from Chile all the way up to the North Slope.
It's different. It's kind of weird to go back down to Southern California and see my friends that have houses and families and kids of their own. And I'm like, well, I've got to see a lot of the world. That's really cool, right?
Eventually, they'd like to put down roots. But first, they wanted to experience bull deer. The boxes are all unloaded, and Ryan Mong is pulling on his hip waders, ready to push the skiff back out to sea one last time and get down to work.
You know, everybody always, like, says bull deer is a big life changer, but it's just, I don't know, you just feel lucky getting to do it. Because, you know, most people, they just get to come out once or so.
So this might be it?
Yeah, I like living like that.
Did it sound okay? Because I'm in a restaurant right now. I don't know if it's too loud.
It's been almost 3 months since I last talked to Ryan Mong, and a lot has changed. For one thing, he's not on an island anymore. Mong had to leave early after he accidentally cut his hand on a machete.
Luckily, the doctor told me there'd be no permanent damage and that I just need to start, you know, physical therapy.
Injury aside, Mong says the island was everything he hoped, and more. Spending so much time working with a couple like Mudge and Pietschuk made him think.
Kind of hit me. Kind of need to go settle down with my loved one and make her mine for the long run. So I decided out on Bull Deer that it's finally time to propose to my girlfriend and brought it up with her. Unfortunately, on the phone.
Mong followed up in person, bicycling across the west to the national park where his girlfriend works. When he got there, the answer was yes. Reporting on Bull Deer Island, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. Find Outdoor Explorer anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. We're also available online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and our topic today is adventures in field science. We're talking to three scientists who have spent considerable time outdoors in Alaska in some very remote and, in some cases, some quite hazardous places pursuing data, pursuing information. So they're not looking for adventure. In fact, they're probably avoiding it, but they do tend to encounter it, perhaps unintentionally. And my next guest has been with us before. Montana Hodges is a geologist and has written about Alaska and rock hounding. She was with us for that show, which was really interesting. She's at the University of Montana in Missoula, and she has just finished some field work on the coast of the Kenai Peninsula between Seldovia and Port Graham, which is a very, very remote area. And some fairly hazardous waters to be boating in. I'm glad you made it back safely, Montana.
Oh yeah, thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
So, what was the research objective down there west of Seldovia?
Oh, well, I think you had it incredibly well put that we weren't looking for the adventure, but we were looking for the data. So when we went down to Seldovia, I study mass extinctions, particularly interested in the end Triassic mass extinction, which isn't the one that killed the dinosaurs with the asteroid that everyone so famously knows. It's actually one of the mass extinctions that helps give rise to the dinosaurs. They walk right through it. But there's some Jurassic rocks, which are the rocks that occur, the time that occurs right after the extinction. So when everything's starting to recover from the mass extinction, there happens to be a beautiful exposure of the earliest Jurassic rocks with marine fossils in them along the coast from Seldovia towards Port Graham. So I was looking for these fossils that came right after the extinction. But unfortunately, there was no roads to anything that we were studying. And you couldn't even hike, unfortunately, to most of the sites because you have very steep cliffs that go right up into the sea.
Right.
And they have frozen in them 200-million-year-old fossils.
Oh, my gosh. So they've been cut somehow, so to expose these fossils, but there's really, that side of Kachemak Bay is a lot of steep black cliffs, very inaccessible.
Right.
So
yeah,
how do you go about
you
getting
see,
there?
You can see some Jurassic cliffs that people kind of famously walk along in the Homer area as well. That's unfortunately later in the Jurassic, so they didn't have the fossils we were looking for. But the rocks at the time that they were formed, about 200 million years ago, would have been a volcanic island arc. So they would have been a piece of land out in the Pacific Ocean that was eventually accreted onto Alaska. So it was pushed up on the across the Pacific and attached to the coast of Alaska. So what we have now would have been deeper marine sediments at the time. So you have, corals and clams and probably a couple of marine dinosaurs in there we haven't found yet, some ichthyosaurs or something like that.
Well, good luck. Good luck finding
it. It's been uplifted and pushed onto the coast of Alaska.
So I guess you take a boat to Seldovia and then another boat to get out to these cliffs.
Right, yeah. Well, we got on the trusty Testy, which is very close to my heart. I think a lot of adventurers in Alaska have started their journey on the trusty Testy.
For sure.
I'm quite sad to hear it will be retired.
In
Homer, took the ferry over to Seldovia. Then in Seldovia, we had to find a captain who was willing to take us out in late September to these areas. They have extreme tides, which even most people in Anchorage are really familiar with, the great tidal fluctuations of the region. Pretty extreme down there. So you have to take a small boat. In the summer, you could kayak if you were a very good kayaker. But we ended up with a skiff boat captain who was willing to take us out there, somewhat reluctantly take us out there. And when the seas would swell, he would come back. We had radios, and he would just tell us, we have to go. So at one point, we got to the most important site that we needed to be at, and we only had 20 minutes there. And he was screaming at us from, about 20 feet offshore that we're done. We have to leave. That's it. We're leaving. And so I had to take what I could and, kiss the rest of the rocks literally goodbye and wait until next season to get back there.
Tantalizing. So how do you get from the skiff onto the shore? I mean, in a swell conditions, bringing a skiff on shore is deadly.
Right, absolutely. And I think, not only our safety, I think our boat captain was quite concerned about his skiff, his livelihood there, because they can get pushed onto the shore if they go sideways. So we had the fortune of a rubber ducky or a pack raft to take us on and off the boat at times when we really needed it, most specifically to drag us back on when the sea came up. I actually brought my 60-year-old dad with me as my field assistant, and this was his first true Alaskan experience, but he was a great sport. And we had a famous Anchorage paleontologist with us as well, Robert Blodgett, who you've interviewed before.
Yeah.
And so we had to, in the rough seas as it's rising and the wind is whipping, you have to jump on that little raft and have them pull you out to the skiff further off the shore and then jump in. But of course, I sent the rocks first. So we got the rocks to safety and then the people.
Yeah. So, it's not the best time of year to choose, but it sounds like you've done some other fairly challenging and difficult outdoor work in Alaska. You've done some work in Denali, right?
Absolutely. I had a wonderful internship there with GeoCorps, which is kind of like the AmeriCorps of geologists, and I was able to work on dinosaur material in Denali National Park.
And that's perhaps not the same hazard of jumping off a boat into huge waves, but can be pretty challenging as a backpacking expedition. And I would think if you're carrying rocks around, even more so.
Well, luckily, it was a national park, so we had to leave the rocks there, which was one of the best things that could happen. Yeah, we were documenting. We were out exploring for new sites, looking for more of the ichno fossils, which are trace fossils. They're just imprints up there in Denali. They have footprints and all kinds of even skin imprints from the dinosaurs, but they haven't actually found any bones yet. But our job was to document the sites in the backcountry looking for new new exposures of the rock, which is quite difficult because Denali is very highly vegetated. And then hopefully within those rocks we would find some more of the dinosaur material. And it was midsummer, which the mosquitoes are wicked in Denali, everywhere in the interior. I mean, it gets worse as you get further in there, but it's not the most pleasant way to spend a week of backpacking when you have the sunlight and the mosquitoes just swamping the tent. Yeah. I always joked with my colleague at the time that we want to design a bug burqa, kind of like a net, but more like a dress, because for women it's quite difficult in the field. If you catch my drift with the mosquitoes, it is. It was really, really a hard time.
Your rear end can get really, really, really bent. Yeah.
Miserable. So yeah, you're these thinking are the things like, you don't think about when you accept the job, and then the challenges of the summer in Denali. So
you're thinking people.
That was a great experience. It was not death defying, but I would say it was much more uncomfortable than jumping in the freezing cold ocean and hoping they would pull me onto the boat.
And you're thinking people do this for fun, you know?
Yeah, they do. They absolutely do. Probably most people who listen to your show have done that for fun.
Yeah.
So and you know, it's an unfortunate thing, but if you stay low along the creeks where the mosquitoes are, that's usually your best route, your fastest route to get out into the backcountry in Denali, as opposed to, you know, bushwhacking through the vegetation.
Right. That's got its own form of special torment to go through the willows and stuff. So we were talking earlier with archaeologist Morgan Blanchard about the fact that when you're looking for something, you might actually be going places that most people wouldn't really be interested in going to, right? So if I'm out for a backpacking trip at Denali, I might just look for the most beautiful spot, or I might head for a ridge top or something like that. What sort of spots are you looking for to find these dinosaur tracks? Well, you know, what are you looking for, like particular kinds of rock or something?
Yeah, and you know, this is the interesting thing about Alaska and the interesting thing about geology in Alaska. So I was just at USGS talking to some of the geologists who work there, and we were talking about, they had a great analogy. They said, mapping that's been done on rocks in Alaska, they're like postage stamps. Someone picks an area and they go out and they maybe spend their lives, their whole life, mapping this postage stamp. And then we try to connect all of Alaska on a map by these little pieces of information we have. So a lot of the times you don't know just because it occurs on a geologic map that it's going to be there. You have to do the research to find out how deep in detail someone has ever worked in that area. So it's hard, and a lot of the times we would look at Google Earth, zoom in as much as we can, say, oh, does that look like an exposure, you know, 15 miles off the park's road, and, you know, kind of look at the topography and guess, and you might get there and it's not an exposure, or things have changed over the last few years. The rocks in Denali happen to slump and slide a lot. They slip around, so things that you see on Google Earth from 2009 might not look the same, and it might not even be rock. And so it's a real challenge. I mean, Alaska could use about 1,000 more geologists working on it right now, and it's not even going to put much of a dent in what we know about the geology of the state.
Fascinating. So as an amateur,
it's a real challenge.
So, and there's in Denali, there's a ton of broken rock and scree. Is that of interest to you? At all?
Yeah, we were looking in a lot of that material. So we were looking in a real shaley material that's kind of like the stuff that breaks off in little sheets and little square-shaped chunks. A lot of the dinosaur material was in that, and that was that material that we were looking at happens to break off in big slumps. So a big side of a mountain can kind of slump off and expose new stuff, which is cool because it exposes new stuff every year. You also lose things, and it also breaks apart quite easily.
So. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and my guest right now is Montana Hodges, who's a geologist, has been studying dinosaurs in Alaska. She's at the University of Montana in Missoula, and she's joining us by phone, but she just left Alaska. And she's also author of a book about rock hounding in Alaska. In Montana, the title of the book is escaping me at the moment. What's the title of your book?
Rock Hounding Alaska. It's really creative.
Yeah. Oh, I got it right then. So
you did.
So what were you doing in the Talkeetnas? I guess you were doing some field work up here there too, right?
Yeah. So I was in the Talkeetnas about 2 weeks ago, and it was 30 degrees and snowing at the site where we were. So we hiked up Camp Creek, which is near Sheep Mountain, and I took a couple of Anchorage folks with me who are just excellent paleontologists who study a little creature called belemnites, a little marine creature. And we were hiking up Camp Creek by Sheep Mountain looking for rock exposures that were documented in an old field report from the 1960s. Once again, we have this problem where we don't have GPS coordinates. We have a mention. We have an old system classification on the maps and going out looking for the site. But when we got about half a mile in, which took an embarrassing 2 hours, everything was snowed in. And we had no way to predict that. We had called Sheep Mountain Lodge, and they were very friendly, and they said, the snow is probably at about the level, that you're looking at, but it's not on the ground by the highway. And you just had to go for it. We had one shot. We thought that might be our last good weekend before we're really snowed out. But our rock unit was covered with snow, so we had to turn around and go back out.
So you accomplished nothing.
Yeah, we did. We accomplished nothing. We had a great hike through some bushes.
Well, that's it. When you said 2 hours to go half an hour, so you were like climbing around through the.
Yeah, we tried to take the creek on the way back, but it was just too overgrown. So it was another just like Denali, one of those experiences. Where you're trying to get into an area. And it's really unfortunate because that is the best time of year to go there because that's, that kind of area, when you're inside the creek bed, it's really popular with bears. And it's really nice in fall because you don't have any leaves on any of the bushes or the trees or anything. So you've got a nice, clear shot of where you're going, and you can see very well. So unfortunately, when we go back next summer, it'll be more difficult to hike in there, not just because of the bears, but also because of the visibility. So.
Yeah, well, I found with bushwhacking Alaska, it's like early spring, when the snow is just gone, that's really the only time when it's all manageable because you can see where you're going. I mean, it's not only the misery of going through the willows and alders, but you get in there and you're completely lost. You can't tell which direction is even which, and you're climbing around, and that's part of what makes it so awful.
Absolutely. And, a lot of, like I said, Alaska is heavily vegetated. So for geologists, it took me 3 years to find enough sites for rock hounding Alaska because there aren't a lot of exposures that are easy to get to in the state in general unless you're driving, up the Dalton Highway. So it's really difficult. And our exposures that we happen to have in the Talkeetna Mountains, they're up creek beds. So we also have to hope in spring, it's that time in spring when the snow isn't melting yet either, because then we're going to have too much water coming down that creek. So it's a real hit and miss gamble. And unfortunately, you can't time it. You have to go out there and hope for the best and turn around and do the same thing again. We can't predict our season in Alaska like we can even down here in Montana.
Yeah, it seems to me that on one hand, I think, wow, what a great job to spend all this time outdoors. I love outdoors. And I kind of love going to obscure places where people, don't usually go. And so that part of it sounds very appealing. But on the other hand, I know there's a lot of stress because you've got money invested in your field work. And if you go out there and you don't accomplish anything, like when the snow falls or you just find tantalizing evidence and you realize you have to leave and come back later, that must be kind of stressful. That must take something away from the fun.
It does. I mean, it's what, like you said, inspires the mystery of when you first go out there and the passion to go because you're unsure of what you're going to discover. And that's the best scientist, someone who's not really sure what they're looking for. They're going to go out and record their observations and figure out what they mean later. But it's also very depressing. The rocks in Saldovia that I literally kissed goodbye when we had to jump back on the skiff in the storm, that was part of my PhD research. I'm supposed to graduate in May. I'm not going to graduate in May. I need to go back to Saldovia and collect some of those fossils and figure out more of what was going on. So it is. It's highly dependent on what happens in the field.
Wow.
And a lot of people don't realize that. Yeah.
Wow. Well, good luck with your research. Good luck with your PhD. Maybe I'll see you on Kachemak Bay next year. Thanks. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks to Montana Hodges. She's a geologist, obviously a PhD candidate at the University of Montana in Missoula. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And now we're going to take a quick break. Speaking of mosquitoes, I'm going to turn it over to our producer, Monica Gokey, who caught up with an academic whose work takes her to the Alaska tundra, and there she's gotten intimately familiar with the mosquitoes.
Shannon Sweet is YouTube famous. A 25-second video she posted of mosquitoes in the Arctic tundra last year went viral. The Huffington Post wrote an article about it. The title read, "Horrifying Alaskan Mosquito Swarm Engulfs Scientists Who Record God-Awful Phenomenon." Here's a snippet.
Holy shit. All right, yeah. They're like biting any piece of skin that I'm showing.
Shannon and her colleagues sling 10 to 14 hour days during their summer field season. They see a lot of bugs. Shannon is a PhD candidate from Columbia University, and she is actually up there to work on the plants. Her research is focused on documenting how climate change is affecting the growing season and what time of year plants are emerging. Up at the Tulik Field Station on the North Slope, access to a phone line is spotty. But Shannon checked in with us through email. She sent some pictures of life on the tundra. Shannon basically looks like an REI/beekeeper version of Nurse Ratchet. She's got the bug head net, Gore-Tex pants, and latex gloves over her hands, which she says the bugs can't bite through. Last year was especially bad for mosquitoes. Shannon attributes it to a cocktail of factors: rain, snow, unusually warm temperatures, a mix of factors that combine to make the perfect swarm. Oops, we mean perfect storm.
Oh my God, the whole horizon is just nothing but mosquitoes as far as the eye can see.
For Outdoor Explorer, I'm Monica Gokey.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 8 on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking today about field science. The scientists who work outdoors in Alaska brave the elements and collect data in places and in conditions where probably a lot of outdoors people would avoid. And my next guest is an old friend, Ann Jensen. She's an anthropologist based in Barrow, who has really made some fascinating discoveries and done some really interesting work over the years in studying the ancient cultures of the North Slope. And Ann is joining us from Fairbanks, where she's doing some work at the museum. Thanks for being with us, Ann.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Charles.
So you were fairly recently in the media because of the erosion situation that's happening on the coast there in Barrow, where some ancient remains are being eroded away into the ocean, which is feels like a tragic loss of information. And I know it's happened all along the coast, Point Hope and elsewhere. So you were kind of out there in pretty bad weather, sort of trying to triage the situation, it sounds like.
Well, yes. We wound up, there was a very bad coastal storm right at the end of August. And unfortunately, I was leaving town for a long planned trip to a couple of conferences in Europe. But there had been some reports from people who had been beachcombing that they thought they might have seen human bones. So the folks at the North Slope Borough Inupiat History, Language, and Culture Commission, IHLC, wanted me to go over and take a look. So it was still quite stormy, and there were big waves. So they actually got the fire department to come over, and they assisted with this. So they tied me, into ropes, and they sent a couple of fellows down with me actually wearing float suits and such, and they were tied to ropes too, and then other people were standing on the bluff where hopefully the waves weren't going to get at them. We didn't quite rappel down the front. We actually walked around and approached from the bottom. But when we looked at it, there was no, we could not see any human remains. We could see part of a house eroding out. There were lots of artifacts and lots of animal bones, and we did collect a few bits of the animal bone, because we thought that might be the only sample we ever got for dating, if the you know, storm got a lot bigger and took the whole thing. And so that was that. Then I left town, and actually a whole big chunk fell off and did expose a few human remains. So they actually had to contract with somebody from, I guess, Fairbanks to come up and do an excavation. And they found just a few bones, not a complete skeleton. So we're not at all sure it was a burial. It may, or if it was, it may have been disturbed a very long time ago. The mound has a number of houses on it. There was also a prior excavation back in the 30s by a fellow named James Ford. So, you know, we just don't know what happened. We know that there was a few pieces of a person, and they'll be reburied.
Well, it must be really tough to be doing your work in those kinds of weather conditions and trying to concentrate and look at what you're doing, but it's stormy and cold and kind of miserable.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was pretty awful. It's, that kind of thing is not so bad when you can actually go home and get warm at night. So it actually gets to be a little bit more stressful when you're, you know, a more remote site and you're camping, and so you have to go, if the weather is bad, you have to go through the bad weather, and then you don't get to go home and sleep in a nice warm bed.
And you've done quite a bit of that over the years, being out in some fairly remote sites.
Yeah, so we spent, I've spent 3 seasons. The project spent 4, but the last one I missed because I had to have my spine fused instead, down at Point Franklin, and we were camping out for about two and a half months a summer, and you know, we didn't heat the tents. Now there's an issue with tent fires and stuff, and in the summer, if you have decent clothing and sleeping bags, you should be fine. But you know, you do burn through a lot of calories. I always said we should fund the project as a weight loss camp
because it's freezing cold and it's wet and it's never really warm. I mean, I guess in these days maybe sometimes it is warm, but typically, you know, 40 degrees, 50 degrees might be a high temperature in those parts, and it's often overcast and wet, and so you just have to work through it.
Yeah, and it's always windy. That's the thing. The wind chills are usually in the 30s. The last 11 or so years, I've spent most of it at the tip of Point Barrow, literally at the tip of Point Barrow, which gets a little further south every year, but it's very windy. You've got wind coming off of the ocean, or at least in the early years, it was coming off of the ice. So it was really cold. I mean, it was, you know, the wind was coming off in the teens or 20s, I suspect. And, you know, even if Barrow was reading something about freezing, we often could see our breath. And, you know, it was pretty awful. But I was living there with mostly high school student crews, but we managed, you know, we had to keep an eye on each other to make sure nobody was getting hypothermic and make sure they warmed up.
And polar bear protection?
Well, yeah, we had actually out there because there is ice around a lot, and even if there isn't, it's a place that they put bones from the whales that they catch in Barrow. They actually put them out there so that the bears are attracted out there and stay away from town, and so there's less chance of you know, human bear interaction or bears having to be, you know, killed in defense of life or property. So they put the bones out there. But then, of course, the bears all know that there's whale laying out there. So they go out. They like to go to the tip of Point Barrow. Now, they don't put it on the site. They put it on the other side of the point, but still. So we actually had bear guards. We normally had 2 when we were working with a full crew, one of whom basically sat on the highest point there was and kept an eye out, and the other of whom actually rode a four-wheeler around the perimeter so that we could concentrate on what we're doing. Because if you're doing archaeology, you're mostly looking down at the ground. So
you don't want a bear walking up behind you, yeah.
Well, exactly.
So, exactly. And our listeners might not really be aware of just the significance of the changes up there, but Point Barrow is, I guess, about 10 miles or so north of Barrow, and there was a village, ancient village there called Nuvik, and used to be that it was ice off of there, probably 9 months out of the year. The point is not where it used to be, right? Is the site of Nuvik even there anymore?
No, where the houses are actually has all eroded. Now, this is not a super recent process. There's actually oral history that suggests that by the 1850s, the village had moved to its last location because of erosion. The people who were around then told a British captain who was sitting in Elsa Lagoon right off of Point Barrow waiting for Sir John Franklin's party to emerge from the Arctic, which of course they never did because they were all dead. But anyway, they were there for a couple of years, essentially neighbors of the people at Nuvik. And so they did a lot of work and some with mapping and traveling together and everything. And what they told them was that their grandparents said the point had been a mile and a half longer in their youth, and that it had been eroding fairly quickly. So they had the decision had been made to move the village to where it was then, you know, where it was in the 1850s. So they'd only have to make one move, they hoped. The longer point was going. And the bathymetry pretty much suggests that there is a much longer, about a mile and a half or so, of fairly shallow water that continues on in the same direction as the point. But it's the rate of erosion has accelerated. They actually did some studies in the early gnarl days, and they had about 3 years' worth of measurements of erosion, and I have about 10 or 11 from the archaeology we were doing, and it's at least doubled. And it actually, I think, you know, it looks like it's actually a steepening curve.
And the ice is absent, and so the absence of ice is a big factor in increasing the erosion, because it has more time when it's being hit by waves.
Exactly. More time and it's being hit by waves. And there's a further thing in that if the ice pulls back farther and leaves more open water between the shore and the ice, even if you take the exact same storm in the exact same place, what makes waves is basically wind pushing on the water. And the more distance it has to put that wind energy and turn it into water, wave energy, the more energy the same storm can put into the waves that are going to hit the beach. So they get bigger and stronger if you have a longer, what they call a fetch, which is the distance, mm-hmm. you know, between shore and ice. And, you know, it used to be maybe 5 miles, if that, and now it's, you know, hundreds of miles. It's a complete orders of magnitude difference, yeah. And it is making a difference.
Making a huge difference for a lot of things, but including archaeology. And so you, years ago, you were the involved in the excavation of the little girl who is apparently a disabled girl who died at very ancient times and was buried in an ice cellar, and so was extremely well preserved. And you did that project cooperatively with the village and with the native people being really involved in it, so that it was done in a respectful way. And that was another of these projects that was sort of prompted by environmental change, right? And how did you develop that cultural component where you were cooperating and you weren't looking at it purely from a scientific perspective, but you were also respecting the kind of the spiritual and the human aspect of it?
I've always thought that archaeology is anthropology or it's nothing, as several people have said in slightly paraphrased versions. But at least in the United States, the two things are in the same, at least have been in the same department, it's the same discipline. I just it's people's ancestors, and it just never seemed right to me not to involve people. Besides, from the earliest days that we came, I started working in Alaska, particularly in the North Slope, the descendants of the people who left the sites were alive. And when I first started there, some of the people that were alive had still at least heard stories from grandparents who had been alive before the Yankees showed up. You know, they had their grandparents had told them stories of seeing the first Yankee ship, the first European ship. So they had direct, from the original witness stories about how things were back then. So, and, you know, people weren't writing it down. I mean, most of them when I came were literate, but certainly their grandparents hadn't been literate. So they hadn't written it down, and it wasn't, you know. So you had to talk to people, and anyway, it's their relatives. It just always seemed like the right thing to do. I mean, just good manners, if nothing else. And besides, it just allows you to do a much richer, get a better understanding, get a much richer understanding. You know, even now, you know, that a lot of the elders that were there when I was starting out have passed on. I mean, I just got a senior discount the other day, you know. So, alas, I'm not young anymore.
But still pretty tough.
But the thing is that, you know, people can still figure out how tools were used, because even if they haven't used them themselves, they've probably seen their grandparents use them, or they have a more modern version, you know. So instead of being a stone tool, maybe they have something that's made out of a shotgun shell or has metal blade, but the handle is the same. And so they can often help you understand how something was used if you just find, you know, a stray find. Or just some new tool type.
So you're getting something out of this. Yeah, you're getting some benefit from being sensitive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And younger people now often come, they, you know, people bring me stuff all the time asking me what it is, you know, and there's actually, in Barrow in particular, there's a very neat book that was written by, it's a John Murdoch. It's actually been published in a Smithsonian volume along with several other reports from that expedition. And it's got wonderful drawings of lots of artifacts that were collected, items of material culture, really. They weren't artifacts. They were things you bought, you know, that people's tools. There were some artifacts, but so you can, and people really love that book. I've bought about 7 of them, and six of them are, you know, they're loaned, and then I loan them to somebody, and they loan them to somebody, and, you know, they're there somewhere in the community circulating. And the library has several, and keep having to get more. But people really are interested in their past and in preserving their past, and it works better if everybody, you know, works on it. And the more you can get people interested, the more they are interested in seeing things excavated the right way, not just, you know, dig up the artifacts for the sake of artifacts. They actually start to, you know, get the whole archaeological thing, which is context. You know, what you find together is important, how things are and where things are.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you, Ann, you've spent all this time, a good long career, a very successful career on the North Slope, where it's cold. And I'm just wondering if you enjoy the outdoor element and the camping out and sort of the being in the elements of your work as part of it. Is that something that gives you pleasure, or is it something that you sort of bear up under because you have to do it to get the data?
Well, it depends on when and what day. You know, I actually had a colleague, the senior colleague, very, very prominent, Don Dumont, who spent in his 80s, and he's still doing field work, but he does it down on you know, southern Alaska and sort of Brooks River, not the Panhandle. But and, you know, like, we went out to look at Nuvuk, a bunch of us, for a meeting, and it was October, so it was kind of cold. And he said, "Ann, you're crazy." And I'm like, "Why? What?" And he said, "It's nasty out here." Nuvuk is pretty extreme. I mean, most of my colleagues, and I guess I will give them that, it's a lot colder than a lot of places. But it's interesting. You know, I don't enjoy getting hypothermia, certainly. But I don't really like hot weather very much at all. So that part of it's good. I like being outside. I happen to think that the Arctic and the North Slope is very beautiful. It's, you know, in its own way. It's not beautiful mountains. It's not Polychrome Pass, you know.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful in its own way. So I do, most of the time, I enjoy that. Now, if it's, you know, blowing 30 and sleeting and whatnot, no.
But it goes with the territory. It's beautiful and wonderful people, and I've always enjoyed talking with you and with your husband, Glenn Sheehan, and appreciate very much your help. Thanks for being with us, Ann Jensen. Ann is an anthropologist in Barrow. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Our show next week, we're having a show on cultural journeys, traditional knowledge and science, how the two sides relate, how they relate in the outdoors, and the connections that can be made between people who view our environment and the outdoors we enjoy in different ways. Our producer is Monica Gokey. Production assistant who helps us arrange guests is Grace Bojean. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Hey, Ann.
Yeah.
Hey. Oh, thanks so much. That was excellent.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I'm glad.